Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
Live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue at heritageradionetwork.org. You can also download and listen to this show through iTunes or Stitcher. I'm your host, Lady Sue. And what do I do when I'm not hosting Word of Mouth? I am out and abouting, having the very conversations that you hear on my show, working with my clients, which include chefs, sommeliers, big brands, startups, all those doing what's most delicious and innovative. This week, we're going to go all over the world. Japan, Australia, Taiwan, Turkey, Vietnam, and so on. I don't know about you, but around the holidays, I get a little bit of wanderlust. Before welcoming today's in-studio guests on People We Like, we'll head to the Green Market with who I go to with all of my questions about Japanese cooking, Hiroko Shimbo, chef and author of IACP Cookbook Award-winning Hiroko's Kitchen. And then after that, today's in-studio guest, we'll welcome Matt Gross, web editor at Bon Appetit. The former frugal traveler columnist for the New York Times has been to over 50 countries. A couple weeks ago, I had him dial in live from Taipei, Taiwan, on a recent trip to visit the in-laws and eat a lot. And he's now in the studio to report back to us, plus travel tips you'll only hear here on Word of Mouth. And then after we hang out with Matt in the studio, we will wind it down this morning with Gordon Little, founder of Little and Peacock Imports, the only Aussie wine boutique wine import company, only Aussie wines in his portfolio, the only one of this kind of a company that we know of anyway. But first, let's go to the Green Market. I'm here at the Union Square Green Market with Hiroko Shimbo.
Hi, hello.
chef and cookbook author of several cookbooks, and Hiroko's American Kitchen won the 2013 IACP America Cookbook Award?
Yes.
Right? Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
So we both love Napa cabbage, also called Chinese cabbage.
Yeah, and in Japanese we call hakusai.
Hakusai.
Yes.
Hakusai.
And one of the most popular winter vegetables in Japan. And we pickle it, stir-fry it, braise it, or simmer it. There are many, many ways to enjoy it.
It's just so sweet. It brings out the sweetness of everything around it.
Yes, exactly. Very sweet. And the interesting thing is, hakusai, or Chinese cabbage, is rich in glutamate, umami. Natural glutamate.
So it's a naturally delicious vegetable.
Exactly. So here, and also lots of rich in vitamin C, which keeps us healthy during the cold winter time. And here we are, the Chinese cabbage.
So we're looking at the...
I am looking for to pick the good one.
Okay.
Has to be heavy for the size, and also just grown tight.
Okay, tight.
Not airy.
The leaves are tightly packed together.
Right. Exactly. And here it says $3 each, which means I'm going to buy, but I'm going to pick the heaviest one. Sounds like a greedy. But that's, you have to work on.
Yeah, some of them are very small and some of them are very big.
Yeah.
And so when you cook them, they shrink down so much.
This can be cooked in dashi. or Japanese stock. Or you can, I sometimes add a little milk or mm-hmm. cream. Mm-hmm. Just the hakusai can go with many different applications.
Well, I love it in the buta yasai nabe.
Oh, that's right.
So delicious.
Yes.
It's a Japanese clear soup. The dashi broth with a little bit of delicious fatty pork. Not very much, just a tiny bit of fatty pork, slices of it, and then tomato for added umami.
Exactly.
And then a lot of this cabbage that just like, it just tastes so clean and
yes,
so good on a cold wintry night.
Exactly. And hot pot, yes, that's the best ingredient. And sometimes I layer the leaf with, you can use bacon or mm-hmm. just a very thin sliced meat.
Mm-hmm.
Then cabbage, then meat, and cabbage and meat.
Mm-hmm.
And then cook a kind of sucked up. And then
like a cabbage lasagna.
Exactly. That's another just a delicious, delicious. Simple,
yep.
Very quick to make. And also, this one I'm going to make tonight.
Okay.
The gyoza, the yum. Hot sticker, or no, gyoza dumpling.
Yeah.
The same proportion of cabbage minced and ground pork.
Yep.
Mixed and use a filling. Oh, just delicious.
Oh, so half and half. Okay, and then
yeah,
half and half before you... Do you chop it up and then do you put salt on it to get the water out?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's the key point.
Yeah.
Chop up salt, leave 10 minutes.
Yep.
Then squeeze to remove all of the nice juice, but have to be removed. And then just mix with the pork, a little tiny bit of sugar, minced onion. No, minced garlic,
mm-hmm.
minced ginger, pork, everything is mixed.
Maybe a little bit of shiitake mushroom.
You're overdoing
it. I'm overdoing it.
Yeah.
my mom used to put like everything in one dish.
Okay, I think that's
okay,
great.
Okay, but simple.
Simple
okay.
is the best.
Good pork, good cabbage.
Yeah, exactly. Organic cabbage could be wonderful. Has more flavor, sweetness.
I'm going to, Hiroko, you wrote a blog piece pretty recently about pickling this wonderful cabbage.
Yes.
I mean, it is actually what Koreans use in kimchi.
Oh,
or the
right.
most typical of kimchi.
Yeah, exactly.
But there's a way to pickle it that is not that, the red colored, sort of the spicier stuff, right?
Yeah, my mother's version, which is just simply use sea salt, good quality sea salt, pickle. Pickling just 1 week? No, 2 weeks. At the end of 2 weeks, the cabbage develops funky, little lactic acid, salty, sweet, wonderful, wonderful flavor. And please visit the blog and you will find the recipe. But the
what is your blog?
Okay, www.hirokozukitchen.com.
That's HIROKOSKITCHEN.com, right?
Yes, thank you, lady. And the quickest or simplest way to enjoy this cabbage or hakusai is chop them up thin or thick and put them in a dashi stock or even chicken stock.
Chicken soup, yeah.
Chicken stock. And add a little salt to taste. After 20 minutes, the cabbage really nice, tender, but still has crispness. And just a gorgeous soup. Sweetness of the cabbage, when the weather gets frosty, cold, the cabbage acquires much sweeter taste. So becoming the sweeter and the sweeter, naturally. Everyone should eat cabbage.
Some good things happen when it gets really, really cold outside.
Exactly. Yeah. snow and the sweet cabbage.
So you did a little bit of research on this, on why Napa cabbage is also called Chinese cabbage. Like, we have no idea.
Right. So I should have some Chinese working in Napa area. Came with the same cabbage, or he planted a Chinese cabbage, and just it is easy to sell as Napa cabbage than Chinese cabbage.
Is that really what do you think? That's your theory.
That's my theory.
That's because great marketing.
Yeah, great marketing. That's the clever marketing, and maybe that's my presumption.
Okay, but, because we tried to Google it.
Yeah, but couldn't find it. None of the place gave me any answer.
Yeah.
So that's pretty nice guess.
I like that guess. Thank you so much, Hiroko, for joining
Thank
me.
Thank you, lady.
Wish I could join for those dumplings tonight.
Yeah, someday you'll be mine.
I'll hope and pray. Okay, thank you. Welcome back to the studio. That was Hiroko Shimbo, Japanese food expert and cookbook author. I'm your host, Leiti Su, and you're listening to Word of Mouth with Leiti Su on heritageradionetwork.org. Some social media infos before we get started. If you like what you hear, or if you really hate it, you can tweet at me. Hashtag WOMSHOW, that's WOMSHOW, short for Word of Mouth Show, at heritage_radio. At Leiti Su, LEITIHSU, our guest in the studio today, Matt Gross, goes by at WorldMattWorld. And on Instagram, he's at WorldMatt, as if that were not confusing. And he works at Bon Appetit, which is on Instagram, at Bon Appetit Matt. They do a fabulous job. We're going to talk about some of that today. And now for People We Like. Matt Gross, web editor at Bon Appetit, travel expert, author of The Turk Who Loved Apples, former frugal traveler, New York Times columnist. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
On the show, we had a little primer on Taiwanese food. Thanks for dialing in live from Taipei a couple weeks ago, the November 12th show. If you missed it, it's archived. You can get it on the Heritage Radio website. So, hey, where's my doggy bag of a mango shaved ice that you promised me?
It melted. No, my daughter ate it all. Something
okay,
like that.
Yeah, she would do that. So, you've got some fun foods to report back to us on. I looked at your slideshow on the Bon Appetit website, and I have to say, like, Taiwanese food is like the picture of my soul, so therefore my soul was on that slideshow, and my soul likes to have goose in noodle soup for breakfast. That's what we do as Taiwanese people.
Yeah, this was one of the cool discoveries I made there. Taiwan is mostly, at least for me, a lot about pork, ground pork, pork intestines, pork, fried pork. But on a breakfast hunt one morning, I discovered that there was this little goose noodle soup stall about two blocks from my in-law's house. And it was just so wonderful. This perfectly clear chicken broth and these ideal al dente noodles, and then just simple sliced pieces of duck on top. And it was a
pork.
What?
I mean, of goose.
Oh, goose.
Yeah.
Goose. Sorry, I'm so used to eating duck.
Which goose is just
but
like
so
that
it,
much
it's
more
such
indulgent.
A neat thing. I mean, Taiwan is weirdly into goose. There's actually another famous goose meat shop near my in-law's house as well. So it's so good. I mean, it's rich. It's a little bit fatty. And it's so excellent with a blob of chili bean sauce.
Yeah,
just you put a little blob of it in the corner of your bowl of noodle soup, and you make sure to get a little dollop of it on each piece of meat. And it's so good, and that's breakfast.
Yeah, and
where do you go from that? That is when you start your day with that. It's who knows what the rest of the day has in store food-wise.
I have very specific, very specific memories of people being upset with me and my Taiwanese food tendencies. So I'll have hot noodle soup at any time, any weather, any season, in the middle of the night, in the morning, whatever, what so have you. And July 4th, like, you know, many years ago, a former boyfriend, I remember we got into this like huge fight because it was July 4th and it was sweltering hot. And all I wanted to do was have like spicy ramen at Toto Ramen. And he was just going to like, he was about to have a fit. And I was like, what do you mean? Like, this is like, you know, you sweat and then you cool off. That's what sweat is for. It's an evolutionary thing.
Absolutely. Noodle soups are the best thing. My measure of a good restaurant nowadays is, do I want a bowl of ramen after I eat at a restaurant? If I don't want a bowl of ramen, then it must have been a good restaurant.
Ah.
But if I do want a bowl of ramen, then, well, I mean, that's actually just normal.
I love it. Well, it's a good thing that you still have kept a svelte figure.
I do. I run a lot.
Yeah. Which I found out the other day that you actually run better when you're hungover, which is like a really, really messed up thing. Like,
I don't understand it, but I'm light on my feet when I'm a little bit hungover.
If only all of us could be superhuman. Okay, so you also checked out one of those fun cocktail bars that, you know, it's a couple of very specifically passionate people in Taiwan, an island that has a hard time getting their hands on some of the spirits that we take for granted.
Yeah, Taiwan is a little bit off the beaten path, just trend-wise and access-wise. But so in the last year or so, a new cocktail bar called Ounce has just opened in Taipei. And it's a very classic speakeasy style. You go to a cafe, an otherwise unassuming cafe.
Like a coffee cafe.
Yeah, like a coffee cafe, yeah. And you walk towards the bathroom, and on the wall next to the bathroom is a little button, and you push the button and wait a couple of seconds, and out comes a guy who looks like he's straight out of Bushwick, Brooklyn, with the mustache and suspenders and the nice shirt, and brings you into this little speakeasy back there.
I find that I feel like I'm in Brooklyn all over the world. Okay, go on.
I mean, it's really cute. It's started by a Taiwanese guy, an Irishman, and some Americans who really like the craft cocktail culture here in the States, but couldn't find anything like that in Taiwan. So they have somehow acquired a massive collection of fine spirits and have this little back room and make some excellent cocktails there. They have no menu. The waiter comes up to you and asks you what you feel like. Do you want something sweet, something refreshing, something warm, something spicy? And then they go from there.
So the staff dresses like they're from Bushwick, Brooklyn, but they are Asian and white.
Yeah, it's a mix of everyone.
All over the world, yeah. Expats, but also some locals that are really nerdy.
Oh, totally. Cocktail
people.
And it's really, it's neat to see the crowd there, too. Because
interesting.
It's not many tourists because, well, first of all, there's not many tourists in Taiwan in the first place. And then, you know, there's definitely some expats who live there, who are going there. But then a lot of Taiwanese. Taiwanese who've lived overseas, Taiwanese who are just into cocktails. Taiwan is apparently actually one of the biggest consumers of single malt whiskey in the world.
Hmm.
Apparently it's a legacy of Taiwan's connection with Japan.
Wow. So Matt and I could talk about Taiwanese food for like 24 hours straight. You know, we could do a Taiwanese food chat-a-thon. Plugging Taiwanese food again, Taiwan is to Asia as San Sebastian, I think, is to Europe. It's like this unusually specifically foodie place where it's like all sorts of Chinese food, but just done better.
I mean, we can say that because we're
in the know.
Taiwanese and unofficially Taiwanese. But I'm sure there's some chefs and some eaters in Sichuan province and Beijing who might argue with that. But you know what? The hell with them.
We're going to put our foot down. And so check out Matt's slideshow. It's a lot of fun. You get a photo of, you get to see a photo of his older daughter, Sasha, like completely ice cream for ice cream. That photo should be titled Ice Cream for Ice Cream. What are your daughters? Okay, so like your life right now, you used to travel all over the world for 10 years, traveling all the time. And then you took a job at Bon Appetit, which has you in town with your two small kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my life is very different today than it was a little bit over a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
I have two daughters, Sasha, who's turning five in a week, and Sandy, who's a little bit over 1 year old. when Sasha was born, it changed my travel a little bit, but didn't slow me down too much. I'd been traveling for the New York Times and for other magazines all over the world. I would go away for a week, 3 weeks, a month, 3 months. But then I had a kid, and it's not really fair of me to my wife and to the kid for me to disappear for long stretches of time. So when Sasha was born 5 years ago, I said, okay, 2 weeks, that's it. I can only be away for 2 weeks at a time. And then a little over a year ago, Sandy was born, and I realized even 2 weeks was too much. So I decided to kind of settle down, and I started looking for a job, and bonappetit.com was looking for a new editor.
Nice.
And yeah, that's where I wound up. And it's a very different life. I mean, my usual commute before this had been, you know, from Brooklyn to Burma, and now it's from Brooklyn to Times Square, which is a much more horrible place than Burma. Well, I've had some bad travel in my day, and traveling to Times Square is one of the worst things you can do.
Yes, yes.
I mean, I like my office. I'm just have some Times Square issues.
Well, and I'm also, there's now a second Otoya that opened up right near you.
Yeah,
right near the Condé Nast building.
Eat there often.
Yes, and I discovered it yesterday because I found myself at the end of a day of many meetings after we had coffee, in fact, and after I talked to Hiroko about Napa cabbage, I had to go get some. I had to go to Otoya. I was just right there. That's
good.
It was excellent. So you wrote a book, The Turk Who Loved Apples. I understand that writers and editors often write books. Mm-hmm. This is something that we do. But what was the precipitating moment where you're like, I'm going to embark on this journey of writing a book?
So I wrote the Frugal Traveler column for a long time. Mm. And I loved doing it. I got to go amazing places and meet incredible people. But writing the column, it was so much practical advice. And it's useful, and I'm sure it helped readers. But for me, the practical advice was less interesting and less meaningful than the things that had happened to me sort of psychologically and emotionally. The ways that I'd learned to deal with the world were not about were only partly about saving money and being efficient and practical. Mm-hmm. It was more about learning to deal with loneliness, learning to deal with sickness, learning to deal with feeling like a superficial tourist, and kind of overcoming those things. So I wanted to write at length as well, not limited to 2,000-word columns.
It's hard to get to write at length in the world of media today.
So the book is about my attempts to come to terms with the harder parts of travel. The things that challenge us more deeply than any, you know, money-saving strategy. And it's not just bad travel. I mean, there's the finer points, the highs and the lows of travel. There's being lonely, and there's meeting people, and there's getting sick, and there's eating fantastic food. So it's kind of my travel philosophy. Embrace the bad to enjoy the good.
It's a quick and easy read, but the loneliness piece really resonated with me because I tend to travel. I like to be in a place for a long time, so that means a shorter list of countries, unfortunately, with the finite time that we have in our lives. And then I like to actually travel alone. I don't mind it. And I went to Buenos Aires alone, lived there for the summer after my after I graduated from college, my perfunctory post-grad trip. And I think that, like, I was actually lonely, and then I did sort of nutty things, but I don't think I realized that I was lonely because in regular life, I had never been lonely. I'm not the type of person to get lonely. So it was, like, this, like, overall feeling of, like, you know, I didn't even know I was lonely. And by reading your book, I realized I was lonely.
But it's good to learn how to be lonely, learn how to be alone. You become more self-sufficient. You become more creative. You become more adventurous because you have no one to rely on but yourself and your own imagination.
Uh-huh. And I also like to pretend that I'm in a music video.
You mean we're not in a music video right now? Who are all those dancers out there? What is this throbbing soundtrack I hear in my head?
So really exciting trip that's coming up for you. You're going to travel alone to Turkey.
Yeah. I haven't done a lot of travel in the last year or so, but
you set a personal record though. So.
Yeah. I went 359 days without getting on an airplane. That was a 15-year record, I think. But in 2 weeks, I'm going to Istanbul just to hang out for a week. No agenda, no stories to write. I have a few friends that I want to see. I want to eat some food. But it's the first sort of solo trip I've done in forever where I really just don't know what's going to happen.
Wow.
I'm kind of excited.
The anti-assignment, anti-Matt Gross trip.
It's weird. You get, as a travel writer, you get so used to traveling as work, traveling for a story, traveling with some higher purpose in mind, something you're going to turn into an article for a newspaper or magazine. And to go somewhere that you really love, to go and do things you love, to eat and experience the city with nothing in mind, that's it's sort of liberating and it's sort of scary. What am I going to do?
I'm excited for you. That's awesome. we're going to actually do a couple of announcements and take a quick break. And after this quick break, we're going to talk with Matt about where a travel writer would go on his honeymoon and tips for what is the right perfunctory post-grad trip these days, given that much of the world has opened up to us, airfares have dropped, and there's so many possibilities. I know I scratched my head real hard when I was trying to decide where to go after graduation so many years ago. A couple quick announcements. Here's what's on my calendar this week. Our friends at Calintro are putting on Millennial Dining Habits, a talk tonight with the likes of Andrew Tarlow, owner of Marlon & Sons, Diner Renards, and Harris Damashek of Underground Eats, and others. Millennials, they're pretty bratty, but they gotta eat. Seriously, though, this is a topic really close to my heart. See you there, 6 p.m. tonight. Two really fun companies I like, Food 52 and Kitchen Surfing, are teaming up to do a pop-up holiday shop and restaurant at the Old Bowery Station all weekend long, day and night. Check out that lineup, because a wreath-making class is the right way to ring in the holiday season. Finally, this Sunday, come hang with my friends Burke O'Halloran and Daniel Luke Holton, who birthed a book called Eat, Inc., featuring chefs and their tattoos. Book launch party happens 5 to 8 p.m. on Sunday, this Sunday, at Antler Dispensary, 123 Allen Street. I hear some featured chefs will be there. So let's cut to a quick commercial break and we'll continue with Matt when we get back.
You are listening to Intrigue by Obesity here on the heritageradionetwork.org.
The following is an actor reading an actual customer email from Heritage Foods USA.
My family and I enjoyed the Heritage Turkey. It was far superior to the regular mass-produced turkeys in terms of flavor and texture. Absolutely delicious and worth the difference in price. We will never go back to the regular turkeys. It made our holidays more enjoyable. Thank you, Heritage Foods USA.
Heritage Foods USA hopes you had a great holiday season. For more specials on pork, beef, and other meats, visit www.heritagefoodsusa.com.
Food is fun at Bon Appetit.
Hell yeah.
Food is fun. And sometimes we forget that. We get so serious about it. So, loving this recent feature on Doritos bread.
Yes, Dorito bread. That is a big recent hit for us. Our editor-in-chief's brother, Andy Rappaport, had come up with this great idea. Make excellent bread out of crushed Doritos. And, you know, it sounds in some ways horrible. It sounds like, you know, awful, like, lowbrow kind of invention. But there's some serious bread-making technique there. crushed Doritos, and they work surprisingly well. And
pulverized.
Kind of pulverized Doritos.
Have to be teeny tiny, right?
Oh, yeah. It's not just little bits. Yeah. It's dust. Doritos to dust. And then it's served, of course, with a crushed Dorito compound butter. And it's incredible. And it's this mix of incredibly lowbrow snack food, Doritos, and highbrow bread-making technique. And that is sort of emblematic of what we're doing at Bon Appetit, is mixing those two.
It's been really interesting seeing the evolution of Bon Appetit within the Condé Nast world, as I was at Gourmet a long time ago before that was shuttered. And then Bon Appetit has really come into its own. Seriously fun stuff.
Since Adam Rappaport took over about 3 years ago, it's changed its tone, it's changed its approach, it's changed its target, and it's really working. I mean, the magazine is doing great, the website is growing by leaps and bounds, and we have fun every day.
Yep.
We put these stories together, and we have story meetings that we don't want to end. We sit around coming up with ideas and making jokes. And feeling great about what we do.
And you run the web.
Yeah, I run the website. Come up with stories, write headlines, edit stories, organize our social media strategies.
Is Matt Ducker on your team?
Yeah, Matt Ducker is... He's a kind of hybrid guy. Okay. He's, I think, officially on the print side, but he's the multimedia editor, which means he does tons of photography.
Got it.
Oversees all of our videos. He does some podcasty stuff. He's really a man of many talents.
Produces good stuff.
We need to find a way to clone him. Is the only problem with him because he has too much to do.
Well, we're nearly at that because we have two Matts. So it's like, which Matt are you talking about? I do enjoy his social media. Feed,
yes.
As we, check it out, Matt Ducker. And so you put so food. Okay, got it. Now let's talk wine. You put a moratorium on wine content.
Yeah, well, we had a little moratorium on wine content on the website because we didn't know what was going to work. One of the challenges with wine writing is that every wine writer has their recommendations. Everyone wants to talk about best budget Bordeaux or some obscure wine region that you've never heard of that is suddenly producing great wine. And a lot of that stuff for most mainstream readers, which are Bon Appetit readers, is pretty interchangeable. And people shrug their shoulders at a lot of this stuff. Why do I care about some grape that I've never heard of from some part of the world I've never heard of? So we stopped doing wine stories for a little while until we figured out what worked. And what works for us is wine pairings for fall movies, for instance. A freelancer came to me and he said, hey, there's this guy in Austin, Texas, who is... I think he's the sommelier or former sommelier for Paul Kwee's restaurants. And he's just started a wine consulting business and he's working with a movie theater chain. And he's going to recommend great wines to drink with fall movies like Elysium and that Robert Redford on a boat movie. And so that's the kind of thing that works. It's movies which everyone loves and wine which everyone loves and putting them together in ways that are clever and inventive and fun, not... superior and
or just sort of
off-putting.
Commoditized wine coverage. I mean, it's like, frankly, at the end of the day, wine content is actually really boring. Wine person, I'm saying it. It's really boring.
Yeah,
really boring.
It's geeky in sort of the worst way a lot of the time. I mean, we like food geekery, but food geekery when applied to, say, searing a steak or making a mayonnaise is so different from food geekery when it's applied to wine writing. So we tend to shy away from that sort of traditional wine writing on the website because we tried it and people weren't reading it. But we put, movies and wine together or video games and wine, and people get into that stuff.
So Gary Vee pioneered the wine video. Have you seen any wine videos that work at all?
Well, we did a video about how to saber a champagne bottle.
Okay, well, that's a crowd pleaser.
I know. I mean, is there a better way to open a champagne bottle?
I can't think of any other way.
Don't you carry a saber around with you just on a daily basis in case a champagne bottle needs opening?
Yes. It's
actually a new thing at Bon Appetit. We issue each new employee with a saber. Because you never know when Adam Rappaport's going to say, hey,
Does everyone on staff know how to savor the champagne?
I should hope so.
Right, because you'd be fired on the spot if not. So perhaps Matt Gross suggests that perhaps Blank is a new black and the new wine writing is beer writing.
Yeah, we've had this weird success with, at the same time that the wine writing has been problematic on the web, beer stories are great. Beer stories do really well. I have a couple of great beer writers, Joshua M. Bernstein and mm-hmm. Lucy Birmingham, who've done some great stories for us. Lucy did a story on the black market beer world. There's this whole underground network of beer traders who exist on web forums and on eBay who are secretly trading illicit bottles of beer. Beer is sort of run by regional distributors in the U.S., mm-hmm. but not every beer gets distributed everywhere.
Of course.
There's these collectors, and they secretly trade beers back and forth. And if you're in with them, you can get access to beers that you wouldn't have otherwise.
This is kind of like when I was a kid and I would get stickers and stationery from the Asian stationery store, and I would go down the street to my friends, and then we would trade stickers and stationery.
But it's with beer.
Yeah. sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, so like there's that. We did a video games and beer pairing story.
Fun.
Based on recommendations from the guy who owns Barcade. What beer do you drink with Frogger? What beer do you drink with Ms. Pac-Man? These things work really well. They're a lot of fun. And we do some traditional, like, one of our best stories of the past year has been 10 gluten-free beers that taste good. You'd have no idea how popular that story has been.
Okay. I know. Gluten-free would be. Okay, well,
these are gluten-free beers that actually taste good. Not just gluten-free beers for the hell of it.
I like that. Now, going back to beer versus wine, why, like, is it just like this overall thing of the way people talk about wine and it's not really figured out yet? You know, because it's like, I think more people drink like Bud Light than people drink wine, but then an equal number of food lovers drink beer and wine. So why is wine content still like sucking? I'm sad for the wine.
I don't know. I think just the history of the way wine is marketed in the U.S., the fact that you kind of have to have a deeper knowledge base of wine to even begin to write and talk about it intelligently, or at least in the traditional ways.
Yeah.
Whereas beer is common. There's ways of appreciating a Bud Light on ice that you have a hard time doing with really bad, plonky wine. I mean, can you think of like, I mean, the closest wine writing comes to that is an appreciation of Two Buck Chuck. And nobody is writing an appreciation of Two Buck Chuck. No wine writer is ever going to admit to actually liking that stuff. But my editor-in-chief can write about how he likes to drink Bud Light on ice.
Well, we're going to work to change that. We're going to work to change that. So,
let me know when that happens.
I'm thinking about it. I'm working on it. I'm brainstorming, but really enlightening, though. What does a travel writer, where does a travel writer go on his honeymoon?
I can give you two examples of what we did.
Okay, so it was like a whole year or something?
Well, no, there were two trips that sort of count as honeymoons.
Oh, okay.
There was the official honeymoon and there was an unofficial honeymoon. The official honeymoon was to Whistler. We went snowboarding for 5 or 6 days
mm-hmm.
and ate and drank a lot. And that was it. It was easy. Actually, it was the first and only time I've ever bought a package trip. There was like some deal on Expedia, go to Whistler for 5 or 6 days.
Is it just because the wedding was so crazy that you just wanted to like put that?
We just like snowboarding.
It's okay.
Like, the wedding was in September and then we delayed the honeymoon till December. And it just totally worked out.
So your honeymoon was like the anti, I mean, you went sort of way more low-key and regular.
I guess. I mean, flying across the country to British Columbia and snowboarding for several days, low-key.
It's low-key compared to going to Burma.
Yeah. But so then the unofficial honeymoon was like a 10-day road trip through Mexico.
Okay.
That was, in some ways, a total disaster. We started in Mexico City, drove down to Oaxaca, drove over the mountains to the Oaxacan Pacific coast, and then up the coast to Acapulco and back to Mexico City. But I got sick maybe, 4 or 5 days into the trip, and I mean, there was almost everything that could go wrong went wrong with this trip. My wife, who's Taiwanese, lost her passport.
Is she still a Taiwanese citizen?
She's a U.S. citizen now, but this was back then, and she was still Taiwanese. And Taiwan, if you don't know, does not have a lot of diplomatic representation.
You're basically an alien, like, of the world.
Yeah, you're an alien life form with no embassy to go to. And so we were in Oaxaca City when this happened, and she was trying to find out what the Taipei Economic and Cultural Office, as it's known here in New York, would be called in Mexico City. It was like a Sunday, too. We're trying to find out how to reach Taiwan's unofficial diplomatic representation in Spanish on a Sunday from hundreds of miles away. It was a little bit stressful.
So, I'm going to thank my father here who insisted on, he was like, hey, you know how dads like to be very helpful. He's like, hey, lady, so I'm going to just make sure you have like a Taiwanese passport in addition to your U.S. passport, right? And I'm like, thanks, Dad. Yeah, like that's going to be great. Something I will, hide when I go to China.
No, but a Taiwanese passport is not so bad now.
Really?
It's much easier to travel on a Taiwanese passport.
Excellent.
Yeah, there's visa waivers for the U.S., for most of Western Europe, for England. So it's much more useful than it used to be. It used to be you had to get a visa for everywhere you wanted to go.
But is it easier than with a U.S. passport?
Because I have to. No, I mean, U.S. passport is still pretty good.
So basically,
not as good as a Danish passport, but...
Last question for you is the perfunctory postgrad trip. Travel has changed a lot.
Define it's easier perfunctory. To
travel. The thing that kids do when they graduate from college. How, if you were someone graduating from college right now, how would you think about that? How would you pick your country? Where would you go if you? Because I know you went to Vietnam.
Yeah, that's exactly what I did. Mm-hmm. I finished college and then I just moved to Vietnam. I mean, I moved there.
I understand you're an unusual bear, but...
I don't know. I mean, I would say... I mean, I chose Vietnam for two reasons. One, I love the food.
Mm-hmm.
If I was going to live Asia for a year, I wanted to live somewhere where I really liked the food. And I think that's not a bad reason to go somewhere. But then, on the other hand, it was 1996. The U.S. and Vietnam had just reopened diplomatic relations the previous year. Vietnam was booming. And it was a chance to see this country that I'd only ever heard about in history books and in movies and TV. And I could actually go and see the real thing and understand what this place was that had changed the lives of the generation that came before me. So it had this sort of deeper meaning as well. I don't know if there's a place like that for Americans these days. Cuba would not be bad. If you're looking
but the
for
the food isn't like super
the food
awesome.
Is not great. Although, I would go to Burma. I mean, Burma is opening up right now. There's tons of opportunity. There's a lot of exciting change going on. That's where I'd be. There or Turkey would be a lot of fun. Turkey is a huge country.
And delicious.
It's delicious. It's not just Istanbul. There's a ton of places to go. There's lush countryside. There's desert landscapes. There's the eastern part of the country, which is far more sort of Middle Eastern than the western part. Turkey and Burma. Those are your options, college students.
Thank you so much, Matt Gross, web editor at Bon Appetit. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's fun to be here.
We have a little teeny bit of time left. We're going to wind it down with Gordon Little, founder of Little Peacock Imports, the only Aussie-only wine import company that I know of. And we're thrilled because the world of Australian wines is moving beyond the $10 bottles of Shiraz that everyone has come to expect.
Wine down.
I'm Gordon Little, founder of Little Peacock Imports, boutique Australian wines. There's a huge niche to be filled, particularly with top-end Australian wines. And I think that Australians have kept a lot of really delicious wines to themselves. A lot of wines are small, comes from small wineries, very limited production, and they're drunk by locals, and that's effectively the sorts of things that we've been drinking at home while at the same time sending overseas a lot of bigger, bustier Shirazes, sometimes to win Parker Point, sometimes not, but I think we're at a stage now where a lot of the smaller guys are also starting to explore the export markets. I have a theory that Australians, because of the high taxes that we have on wines that push imported wines up to be extremely pricey, that we have sort of created our own world of wines and styles that you can get really anything, and particularly with plantings of varietals like Nero d'Avola and Dolcetto and Fiano. It's like we're making a lot of these sort of versions of these wines that we would otherwise have imported if it was a lot cheaper and lower taxed.
How much is the tax?
39%, which is extreme. Tax is 39% on wine, which is really enormously high. I think one of the exciting things that I'm able to do, having just an Australian portfolio, is when I go to see sommeliers or buyers, I am taking, you know, might have days where I just focus on a single varietal like Shiraz or Chardonnay, and I will bring 4 to 6 different versions of that grape from different regions at different price points, and really give people a chance to see the huge, immense regional variation and stylistic variation. Because, you know, I think when you have a world portfolio, you probably don't do that, and Australian wine gets lost in a bunch of Sancerres or Chinons. But when you just have this Australian focus, you really can get to a little bit more of the depth, and that is super exciting, because you can really see that Shiraz is not one grape. It comes in a litany of styles. Australia is almost the same size as America. It has 60 different wine regions, and it only has 23 million people, almost everyone who lives close to the coast. Ask your local restaurant for some Australian wine, and if they don't have any, get them to buy some. Say Little Peacock. But yeah, definitely, like, restaurants and stores will buy Australian wine if they perceive that there is a demand for it. And I think that if once you guys get the Australian wine in your glass, you'll realize that it really is something appealing, and that you'll want to drink more of it. I think look for some fun and different varietals, such as Pinot Noir, Riesling, Semillon, Chardonnay, and any sort of cool climate Shiraz, because I think that's super exciting and different. There's more to Australian wines than Jacob's Creek, Rosemount, and Yellowtail.
That was Gordon Little of Little Peacock Imports. You can find his wines at Frankly Wines, Wine Shop, Cork Buzz, Rouge Tomate, and other of our favorite restaurants. This is Word of Mouth with Leyte Su on heritageradionetwork.org. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, eat well, be swell.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.